Yes, indeed. And for George Norrie, he'll be back. He'll be back refreshed, recharged, rejuvenated, and ready to do that voodoo that he do. And he does it so well. And I'm so happy to be able to sit in his chair and congratulate him on 10 years of spectacular programs and just expert navigational skills at the helm of the mothership. Well, I'll tell you what, Dr. Bob Wright, we're about to be joined by him. He is a first-time guest. Let me tell you about his books, Transformed, The Science of Spectacular Living, and his, well, I say books, book, and website, drbobwright.com, drbobwright.com, and writeliving.com, writeliving. There's the right way and the right way, the Dr. Bob Wright way. Tonight, we are going to discuss the crossover between hard science and human development and how science is debunking our repeated investment in popular myths that ironically deny us true happiness and lasting fulfillment. We will discuss his research on positive deviants, outliers, who demonstrate abnormal positive traits. What? Yes. And what we can learn from them. Dr. Bob Wright is next on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. Dr. Bob Wright, welcome to Coast to Coast AM. I think it is providential or borderline providential that you should come on the program tonight. Welcome.
Well, thank you, John. And I'm eager to hear how it's providential or borderline providential.
Well, you know, this is a wonderful book. Transformed, The Science of Spectacular Living. And just at the very front, this a couple of notes, Matt Booty, former president and CEO of Midway Games, says that Judith and Bob Wright excel at connecting the dots between dreams and deliverables. And then on the other side of the page, I came to write during the bottom of the economic recession in 08, experiencing a deep sense of hunger and humiliation without business prospects. I now lead within two highly successful startup ventures and enjoy an exciting, powerful, and vibrant life. And it just seems to me that the nation is suffering, and we have several million people. Many of them are doing all right. Many of them are content and happy, and they feel like they're fulfilled and they're living a serious, I don't mean like grumpy serious, but a serious and sincere life, and they're happy in it. But a lot of the nation is worried about everything from the money situation, the job situation, the national money situation, just politics in general, threats of war, just stress coming from all directions. But I have a feeling that you'll be able to lead us through all of that, past the fear, and deliver perhaps a solution that will enable us to just go ahead and kind of be happy anyway without actually just whistling past the graveyard.
Well, that's a pretty amazing summary, because transformation is one of the most challenging things we can do in our lives, if not the most challenging. And there is no quick fix. People that, you know, offer quick fix or quick money, if you get behind the scenes, you know, they generally don't have many of the people they work with do that. But with this transformed process, people begin to experience greater satisfaction and fulfillment in everything they do, because they're operating differently. They're operating from what we call their yearning. And that's one of the key distinguishers between transformers and others. And every one of us is capable of that, but we have to learn to read our internal signs. The transformers in the study were much better at sensing their inner yearning. We'll talk more about that in a bit, I assume. And they were better at following that, and that leads them to both greater satisfaction each moment and greater success in outcomes.
Let me ask you this. We're just going to have ourselves a conversation here, and if my questions are obtuse, just say so, and we'll move on. What's the difference between being led by something and, in other words, following a path and blazing your own trail?
Well, if it's a genuine path of any kind of development, you should need to blaze your own trail in it. If you're a tennis player, you're going to learn to play tennis in a certain style, in a certain way, but you're going to have to do it your own way. The biggest problem in our world, if I go big right away, is we're not being trained in school to live our own values, our own way, and we're not learned, we're not learning how to really have life be our life. And so I may follow somebody else's path if I have gone through traditional education, but that doesn't mean I know how to be myself. And so there's a big, big difference between just doing what somebody else is teaching you to do. We just came back from Nepal, and we met with a number of different Tibetan Buddhists, top Hindu teachers, and they did what they're supposed to do. There's almost nothing individual in the path. And some of them have had very significant results that have shown lifetimes of rebirth and perfection. It's really impressive. But there's nothing about the individual being themselves and developing into that unique gift that each one of us is to humanity. Because each one of us, in our opinion, is a unique, important aspect of humanity that needs to be developed for itself.
Well, it does seem there's been a... It seems like there's been a de-emphasis. I was about to ask you. You said we're not being taught in school, and it prompted the question: well, what are we being taught in school? Because certainly there's a de-emphasis in the right of the individual to be individual, as Patrick McGoohan submitted to us in his breathtaking series back in the 60s about the making into the Borg. Of a just a sort of a common mentality and defeating the individual.
Well, we're talking about going from bad to worse, because you got to figure our schools were originally designed on a conveyor belt model, that they were to produce people who were to take place in society, and those places were somewhat limited. And today, the emphasis on teachers to get kids to know more is causing a reduced individuality, because the kids have to have all the right answers for the right test to get in the right schools. And it starts in preschool now.
Yeah.
Fear runs everything.
So the first step is to clear the fear, it would seem.
Well, or befriend the fear. See, fear has a positive function to get us to safety. And when we become friendly with our fear, we can think more critically and more objectively. And I was talking to someone about high schools recently, and a new Trier High School in the Chicago area is third in the state now. It was tops in the country when I was a kid. They actually did a study of the class in 1967 from New Trier and wrote it up in the Chicago newspapers. And almost 50% of that class were MDs, JDs, or PhDs. And one of them was a friend of mine I had gone to undergraduate freshman year with, and then later on our paths crossed. And the anxiety that he experienced not getting into med school, you would have thought that his life had ended. And he was president of the class. He was a very driven guy. I would say his capacity to enjoy life was certainly greater than a slug, but I'm not sure how much greater.
Wow. Okay. All right, then. Transformation, that means change into something else.
Yep.
So what do you mean by that, and what's the difference between growth and transformation?
Well, so growth is learning and growing. We distinguish learning as what I know today that I didn't know yesterday, and growth is doing today what I didn't do yesterday. So I can learn and grow and get better at any number of things, but I'm still doing what is ordained in that program. Transformation in our research is only transformation when you're doing something you'd never imagined. You grew up imagining you were going to be an attorney, you were going to be a doctor, you become an attorney, become a doctor. That's not transformation. That's you becoming who you could become. In order for transformation to happen, you need to learn to tap into who you are in very deep ways. You may, in fact, still become the doctor, the lawyer, whatever you want it to be. It's not about the exterior, but the way that you operate would not have been possible in what you chose. And that's universal in the transformers we study.
Is there some sort of a security that a person feels by sticking with the paradigm that they're not delighted with, They're not in the deep end of the joy pool, but it's okay. It's safe. Is there some fear that has to be overcome before they just, say, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to be an accountant anymore. I'm going to be a forest ranger or whatever, you know?
Well, see, our mind thinks in categories. So I tend to go from accountant to forest ranger. But life is really very much different than that. I had an attorney come in to see me, and he wanted to be a poet, a novelist, or a politician. And he'd gone to all the right schools. He had the right degree. He worked for the right firm. And he was vehement that, nope, it's not going to be the law anymore. And I said to him, I said, do me a favor. Let me just see how good an attorney you could be, because he was coasting. And I said, are you willing to, for a week, be the best attorney on your team? He said, what do you mean? I said, are you willing to review all the briefs ahead of time? Are you willing to work your briefs over? Are you willing to work with the team? They run a big energy team. And he said, well yeah. And he comes back the next week to me, and he says, I can't believe it. And I said, what? He said, well, the law is fun. Oh, well, tell me about that. See, the problem that we need to face isn't these big moves of becoming somebody else. It's actually learning to be fully present where we are and learning to tap that deeper yearning.
What typically stands between a person and that?
It's almost like we were raised with tennis rackets in our hands, and we've just never been on a tennis court and see somebody do it. We have a natural capacity to yearn and to follow that yearning into engagement, which is the second phase of transformation. And when we engage from our yearning, we automatically learn. We learn, we grow, we share of ourselves. We begin to understand that every one of us is programmed. Who I call me is resident in my brain as what we call the matrix. That when I was a very little kid and my mom began interacting with me, there were certain things she liked and she didn't like. And those things defined me as okay or not okay. The way that the brain works is you have neurons in the brain that fire together, and that makes a neural connection that carries a charge over it. When many similar patterns happen, it's as if a superhighway gets built in the brain. Let's say I grew up with children who should be seen and not heard. Well, then there are a lot of implications in that. What I think doesn't matter. I need to be quiet. I need to be careful. To step out of that, the fear you're talking about, is like it's like the zoo, where they had the polar bear before they built the habitat in a very small cage. And this polar bear would pace from one end of the cage, stand up on his hind legs, turn around, plop down, and go to the other end two steps, turn around, rise up on his hind legs, plop down, and go to the other end. And it was really painful to watch the polar bear go back and forth in this cage. But there was this beautiful, beautiful habitat around the polar bear. And when it was finally ready, they drugged the bear, dropped the bars to the cage. The press was all there to take pictures. And what do you know? He gets up and starts walking exactly the same pace. So the cage that we all live in is our habits. The fear you're talking about is to step outside of those bars. It's to do something new that for one reason or another we've decided wasn't okay. Because we build injunctions, we build limits into ourselves as we get programmed in the first place, as our matrix develops, and we must face our fear to rematrix.
All right. Now, Dr. Bob, your doctorate is in psychology?
Education.
All right. And so what led you to this work? And what led you to the conclusions that you're in other words, what were the steps in your research that resulted in this rather fantastic writing that you've published?
Well, we've been discussing the school system. I had a very different experience in school. I'm a child of the 60s, so I took the obsession with humanism and the truth very literally, and I had parents who never once asked me about a grade, and went to a lot of different schools and personally had my own reality blown at an early age, and followed that into Eastern spiritual disciplines. I've been a meditator for over 40 years, and I learned a great deal about meditating and other spiritual schools. And that's what got me actually into the psychology end of it, because it was really useful to help people understand their world. It's a long story that's not worth going into, but I was vehemently against this kind of work until I experienced it firsthand and saw myself changing, learning, and growing.
Vehemently against this work?
Oh, I went to high school. I was president of my graduating class. My friends were the best and the brightest. And they made the mistake of going into the student counselor. And the student counselor told my friends that they were latently suicidal. I mean, you don't tell a young, sensitive high school kid that stuff.
No.
Well, unbeknownst to me, down the road, her husband was actually at my cousin's high school telling kids the same kind of junk. And they ended up being a murder-suicide pair.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. And in addition to that, my mom was our grade school secretary, and the social worker was her friend. And I remember, you know, vividly her at our kitchen table on Saturday mornings crying in her coffee about some neurotic thing. And so my picture of life was that it's these crazy people perpetrating their craziness on others. So I'm vehemently against, yes.
Well, that makes perfect sense. In fact, I don't know, I'll think about this, but I had a very similar experience in high school with a teacher that was obsessed over notebooks. You had to have a notebook. You didn't really care what was in the notebook. It was a very easy class. A's right across the board. It's like, well, we're not getting any handouts. We're not doing anything. It's just to make sure and turn in your notebook. It's like, well, what do you want us to do? Like cut out pictures? No, just make it any way you want to. Don't have to have much in it. Well, he didn't like this notebook. And he gave me an F in the course. I ran into him some years later, and I was rock and roll and going along and, you know, doing a lot of things for the sake of vanity, like, you know, driving an E-Type Jag and stuff like that. And which I bet I pushed that damn thing 20 miles during the time that I owned it and drove it. It
was, but you had a Jag.
Unbelievable. 66 model, good grief, you know.
Oh, yes.
Lucas Electrics, all I had to do was rain and stuff. Smoke would start coming out of places. Now, I ran into this teacher, and I was still mad at him because I had to do a summer course. So when he said, well, you look like you're doing well, and I said, well, you don't think some idiot that didn't like my notebook is going to stand between me and a future, do you? Thanks, pal. Good to see you. Just being a, you know, an arrogant, smart aleck. But like I say, I was still mad at him.
Yep.
And to help me, it was not even 2 years later that this person put a pistol to his head and dispatched himself.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So he was putting his unhappiness on you.
That's what it would appear. Well, I'll tell you what, we got to take a break, Dr. Bob. Can you hold on to your thought and just refresh my memory when we come back? And we will come back with Dr. Bob. I want to know how to transform. I want to know more about the science of spectacular living. We'll get into it and a lot more, I'm sure, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's in for Nori. Hey, go by the coasttocoastam.com website. You will see some interesting things in the news. Galactic pileup may point to mysterious new dark force in the universe. That's just what we need, a new dark force in the universe. A rare photo of A-bomb split cloud found in Hiroshima and a bus-sized sea monster found took on prey its own size. Now, that's a healthy appetite. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob Wright, Transformed, the Science of Spectacular Living. We'll find out if it's possible to do this on a mass scale or if it's just going to have to be one at a time. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Bob Wright, we touched on a couple of things. The teachers, or rather the counselors, that were telling the kids, you have latent suicidal tendencies, and I touched on that thing about you made the comment that he was projecting his unhappiness onto me, and so forth. Just touch briefly on this. Does this? I suppose a good case could be made for this happening to a lot of people, and I also wonder if maybe unhappiness and misery is being projected on us individually by things like the mass media.
Oh, absolutely. The mass media, the social context we grow up in, is a key element of how our matrix gets formed. So remember, we have the yearning. Your transformers yearn more immediately. They engage off of that. They learn more. They learn their program. They liberate. They step out of that program into new behaviors and actually re-matrix. So we've taken all of that in, whether it was from our family or from our society, and it's defined what the world is and what it expects of us, who we are, what we can expect from the world, and that defines those bars of the cage that we're afraid to walk out of. And even though things are fantastic the other side of the cage, we're afraid to go at it. We're like somebody who's, you know, looks down a grate inside of the road and you see a $10 bill. You reach in, but you can't quite get the $10 bill out. Somebody walks by us and they drop a $100 bill on the sidewalk. Well, we won't let go of the $10 bill to get the $100 bill because we're afraid. And they call that loss aversion. So I have to be willing to let go of what I have to have what I could have. I have to let go of what I am to be what I could be. And that's what transformers figure out how to do. They figure out how to listen to themselves internally and follow their deeper yearning into greater ways of being.
How is this done?
Well, the language is remarkably simple but not easy to pick up. In our society, emotional language is shut down. Our mechanism, our body, has a pleasure-pain mechanism to it. We're built to go away from pain and towards pleasure.
Yes.
Throughout our upbringing, we like holding shiny objects. We like looking at shiny objects. We break things. We play with things. We throw the food. We're learning about the universe. And little by little, we learn more of what we don't do than what we can do. And the matrix gets formed. It gets set into place. It says who I am and what I can do and what I can't do. I've now been building my prison. We have no choice as social animals but to actually grow into some degree of prison. I hope in the future that changes. But right now, the best parents are still limiting their children, and I suspect it's just how it's going to be forever. And so that I have to, and in shutting me down, we all have certain emotions that we think are okay or not okay. The first step for most of the transformers that we've trained is to learn their emotional vocabulary. For a lot of people, anger is not okay. They've never seen it used well. They have to reawaken to recognize their anger in the moment. So the number of people that will tell you they're not angry is huge. You know, with my uncles who were in World War II, they weren't afraid unless you were literally pissing your pants, which happened when they flew in bombing runs over the Palestine oil fields.
Oh, man.
And to them, anything else wasn't fear. So,
yeah, no kidding.
Most of us have got an extreme and limited interpretation of some emotions, fear, hurt, anger, sadness, and joy. Those are the primary arbiters of that pleasure-pain mechanism. So when I'm young, let's say that anger is not okay. Anger and fear were not okay, actually, in my family growing up. And so I learned to live around those things. Sure, I occasionally get angry, but it's not like present with me all the time to ask the question, am I satisfied in this time in life? So there are degrees of having it available. The transformers must learn how to recognize these emotions because the emotions are the arbiters. They're the workhorses of our pleasure pain mechanism. So that as I start listening to my emotions, for example, fear has a function to move away from danger towards safety. But I also have now a conscious mind, so I can use that fear to say, oh, this is dangerous. I got to be more careful, but it's going to be so cool when I get it. And then hurt is very interesting because it's to get to the course of safety and healing, and it's how we learn. And then anger is the crossover emotion because it's about getting away from pain and acquiring pleasure. That's the two-year-old at the grocery store that wants People magazine and is going to die if he doesn't get it
right. And
can't even read. And then sadness is actually the loss of pleasure, and pure pleasure is joy. And we must learn to live to those things. We've got a guy in the program right now who's not mentioned in the book, who is a genius, PhD in philosophy, consultant, makes tons and tons of money. For his family growing up, joy was the most dangerous emotion.
Talk about your research involving the positive deviance. That's not normally a nice word, a deviant. What is a positive deviant?
Well, let's get the background of positive deviance a little bit, because there was after the U.S. had left Vietnam as a military force, World Health Organization found that 85% of the Vietnamese children were suffering below minimum World Health Organization standards. And so this young couple got a grant for 6 months to go there. They're 3 months into the grant, and they go, holy cow, we don't know what the heck is going on here. And then they said, well, but not everybody's sick, so let's study the ones that are healthy. As a matter of fact, the kids that are healthy tend to cluster in families. Let's study these families. And they find that these families are doing things that are forbidden and considered dirty. They're eating shrimp out of the rice paddy, which is considered unclean. They're eating roots that are considered unclean.
Disgusting.
And they're washing them. Also something not generally done. And they sit down and eat at a mealtime. And they went, holy cow. Now how do we change people to doing what these positive deviants do? And so they put it together, and then they had to teach. They had to have parties where they would eat these things. People would discover they're okay. They had to educate people how to do it, and it really began turning it around. And the question you asked at the break is, you know, is it one person at a time, or is it are there societal solutions? It's always going to be one person at a time. But if enough people do it, they'll begin radiating and teaching others to do it, just as they did in Vietnam. So with positive deviance, you're looking at a standard bell curve, and one deviation above and one deviation above the mean, the average, is about 66% of the population. Two standard deviations above and two standard deviations below get you to about 95th percentile. At three standard deviations, you're at 99th percentile and less. So you're looking at people who get done what a system wants to do in non-traditional ways almost always. And these non-traditional ways frequently require breaking the rules. Now, interestingly, positive deviant studies have been going into corporations. Intel Corporations hires the same guy we hired to do our initial research. And they'll go in, identify positive deviants. You've got to figure they have thousands of people in certain jobs, and they'll find the one or two that are blowing the doors off of their job. They'll study those people. Within 5 weeks, he can have all of Intel doing that behavior.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Well, he's only working on one behavior. We're working on transformation. But he's the guy that we brought in to study our positive deviance so that we could find out what was really going on for us, because we loved our curriculum. We had been refining it. We did our first research 20, 30 years earlier. In 81, we actually started researching what works and what doesn't work in this human growth and development space. And we heard a lot of things that were not so, complimentary, and have made a lot of changes and shifted our curriculum. So we're deep into the curriculum. We know that we're all full of baloney, So we bring somebody outside to tell us what's really happening, because we know that we're full of baloney about what is happening. So he comes in, does the initial research, positive deviant research, and starts telling us what it is. And then we had to take over because he didn't understand it enough. And the result is this process that the people that blow the doors off of their life engage in. And it, what's really cool is it pulls all kinds of Nobel Prize-winning research together, cutting-edge neuroscience, behavioral economics, and it explains it all and puts together in a powerful package. That was one of the most rewarding parts of this.
Dr. Bob Wright, all right. So did you observe, or did you observe naturally occurring transformers and then determine the path? And if that's the case, did the natural, I'm just calling them naturally occurring ones, yeah, did they get that trait through like a long cultural development of their base group? Or are these just like little, is this like chaotic math theory where every once in a while you get a wild card?
Well, even then, I want to study what makes those wild cards happen. So what, the way our research worked was to take those positive deviants in our school and study them. Then for any good test, it has to be validated and it has to generalize. And so we began analyzing lives. Take Mohandas K. Gandhi, an attorney. Young idealistic attorney on a train in South Africa, he gets booted out of the first class car, begins advocating for the rights of what were called coloreds at the time, and shakes South Africa up dramatically. Over the next 14 years, he is changed. He went from being an uninspiring speaker to being a profoundly inspiring speaker. He went from being an attorney to being a spiritual leader who was potent enough to be brought back to India and lead the charge to India's transformation.
Wow.
Independence. And so, but there is this capacity to tap our inner yearning. And that's, it's easy to say yearning. It's easy to say you tap your yearning, but whether you're Mother Teresa or one of my other heroes is Winston Churchill, they tap that deeper yearning. And what we're interested in and is being able to show other people how to tap their deeper yearning. Some people think that's the strongest part of our research. And it's one of the hardest to talk about because, you know, when we talk about yearning, say, oh, that's nice. Well, that's like saying, well, tennis players hit the ball with a tennis racket.
Yes.
Okay, so we know there's a racket. Well, what makes tennis players good with that racket is the velocity of the racket head, the times that they hit solidly, or if they're doing topspin, a solid topspin, or a cut, or whatever they're doing, and get it across. Well, they learned to do that by thousands and thousands and thousands, probably millions of repetitions. And each repetition, they're noticing, did it feel good or bad, they're doing more of what felt good, they're doing less of what felt bad, they're getting better and better and better. So transformation for a human being requires going back to that yearning and being able to yearn with velocity and effectiveness. And it's really very exciting to watch somebody begin yearning and starting to really do a good job of listening. My sister's reading the book, and she called me in tears. And I said, what's going on? She says, well, first of all, I got to tell you that this is like a love story between you and Judith, and I love it. That's nice. Okay, thank you. It's a very generous acknowledgement. She says, but here's what I really called you for. She said, I'm a salesperson. I've been, and she knows I know that, and she's been selling for years. She said, I let go of all of my goals and started just yearning for people. And I read your section on my yearning to be loved and to matter and to be and to love and be loved, to be heard, to be seen, to be touched, to connect, to belong. And you know what? I'm accomplishing more of my goals than ever without focusing on my goals. I'm just focusing on my yearning, and I engage with people, and our conversations go in directions I never thought that they could go. And of course people are buying from me, but it's almost like a second thought.
I take it people are really subject to ideas that other people, whether it's might have been their parents or whomever, somebody they admired, somebody that had an effect on their thinking and their feeling, that there are things that they should do. They don't necessarily want to, but they've always been told, oh, well, you know, you strike me as a scientist, or you strike me as a cowboy, or you strike me as a whatever. Just like those counselors are saying, you strike me as a person with latent suicidal tendencies. I take it this is somewhat widespread, and it winds up getting hardwired into your head. So if that's the case, this transformation thing is not a quick fix, and it's going to take a while, yes?
Oh, well, let me go back to that first thing, because I still needed to transform, and I had greater freedom with school than anybody I know. I mean, my parents, you know, I went to school in Germany. I went to school in France. I speak fluent German. And my French I can work in. And my mind got blown every time I did something like that, because I was raised in a very narrow world. So I had a little bit of an edge on freedom, but I still had my limitations of who I was, who I wasn't, what I could do, what I couldn't do. And, you know, today I talk to some of the wealthiest, most successful business people in the world about their personal strategy and their business strategy and things I never would have had the nerve to even ask about before. It requires day in, day out. I went through the same process that I'm talking to you about. I had to learn to recognize my emotions. I had to learn to ask for things, because that was, you know, I was raised that you're supposed to, if you have to ask for it, you know, there's something wrong with you. You should have had it already. Whether it was love or money or help, you know, you don't ask for things. Good people automatically pick themselves up by their own bootstraps. Of course, you can't do that. But I was supposed to do that. So
right.
No matter who we are, we have some limitation where, yes, we do need to rehearse over and over and over again.
Well, now, is there much emotional clearing that's required before you can make any even initial progress?
Well, you know, it's interesting. For some people, they're so hurt and angry, and they have built up so many excuses about why they're not who they think they want to be, that to move out of the victimhood and the drama is really important. And in addition to learning this emotional vocabulary...
Quick, Doc.
Pardon me?
Tell you what, hold on to your thought. I hate to do that. These breaks come at the worst moments, but we have to take one. Dr. Bob Wright is with us. John B. Wells in for George Norrie. We'll be right back. This is Coast.